I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
So, Armin, during our journey through our podcast, we've covered Oedipus, we discussed philosophy, natural sciences, the great love poets, and now, of course, the most important subject of all, pets. Pets in the ancient world. By public demand, we're going to talk about how the ancients related to their animals.
Dogs in particular.
Dogs in particular. I mean, I guess a common view might be, well, they were quite unsentimental about animals in those days. They treated them like they were part of the workforce and were much more sentimental. But is that the case?
It turns out not to be the case. There are quite a lot of amazing texts which show us that the ancients loved their dogs in particular. We also know they had cats, and in fact they even had things like pet monkeys. So we hear a lot about these things. But dogs, well, they go back all the way to Homer.
And we like dogs, you and me, don't we?
We love dogs. I mean, so I never had a dog until 4 years ago. And then
It was a COVID acquisition.
A COVID acquisition. And I have to say that I and my family are completely in love with this sweet little Havanese poodle, which, of course, the abbreviation of which is have a poo. And
yes,
I say I love you dozens of times a day to this little furry creature.
How often do you say it to other people?
Exactly. As I said to my wife, you know, I've said I love you far more often since we got our little dog Ziggy than, you know, in many years previously, I'm afraid.
I come home having not been in the house for just a few hours, and Sonny greets me like I've come back from the war. I mean, it's just the sheer delight. And I have to say, that look in his eyes, I don't see reflected in many people's eyes when I walk through a door. So it's always, you know, it's that a friend of mine said, my dog loves me so much. I just wish I was the man my dog thought I was, because they have such a high opinion.
So positive, aren't they?
They're so, oh, it's you. Yeah, it's great. You're the best person in the world. So, so the ancients had a similar kind of resonance with their pets.
Well, when you go back to a story as masculine, you might say, as the epic of Homer, you have these warriors like Achilles and Odysseus and so on. And Odysseus returns home after the 10-year Trojan War and his years of travelling around the Aegean.
And he's been away for 20 years.
He's been away for 20 years, and he had a young hunting dog called Argos when he left. And when he returns to Ithaca, where there are a group of men, about 100 or so, so-called suitors, trying to win the hand of his wife Penelope in order to take over the kingdom that was Odysseus's. And they are wasting the household's assets and generally behaving very badly. And Odysseus knows that they would kill him if they thought that he was returning to reclaim his kingdom. So he disguises himself until he's in a position to kill them all, which he does in an extravagant moment of revenge using his famous bow. And so it's a big revenger's tragedy. But at this point, anyway, he is disguised as a beggar, and he meets the swineherd Eumaeus, who takes him past the dung heaps outside the palace, his palace in Ithaca, and he sees his dog. And this is how Pope translates it. Actually, I've slightly adapted the translation because it's got some phrases and things which I think wouldn't work so well for a modern hearer. But anyway, here it goes. Abandoned in neglect, poor Argos lay, unhoused, uncared for in the public way. And where the heaps of rank manure were spread, a swarm with fleas he made his filthy bed. As they conversing to the city drew, the faithful dog his ancient master knew, and recognizing well his voice and tread, pricked up his ears and raised his heavy head. Seeing Odysseus, him he strove to meet, and tried in vain to crawl and lick his feet. But strength alone he had to wag his tail and greet his master, though to no avail. Deep pity touched Odysseus to his soul, and down his cheek a tear unbidden stole. But unperceived he turned his head and dried the falling drop, while silently he cried. What sorry beast in this abandoned state, he asks, lies helpless at Odysseus' gate? His bulk and beauty speak no vulgar praise. I warrant such a hound saw better days. To him the older man his head inclined and said, he served one of a noble kind, now long since perished on a distant shore, who will, alas, behold him nevermore. You should have seen dear Argos bold and young, swift as a stag and as a lion strong. Now time has sapped him with his master lost, and many years on stormy oceans tossed. So said Eumaeus, and strode on ahead, and faithful Argos dropped his tired head. Their 20 long and dismal years had passed, he'd lived to see his lord again at last. Now night descends upon his weary eyes, he wags his feeble tail for joy, and dies.
Oh. Well, as a dog owner, of course, I find that very moving.
Terribly sad.
And also the fact that it's the memory of when they were both younger, of course. It's a tense scene, because if he's revealed and the dog recognises him, he might be revealed as Odysseus. So he has to hide it by ignoring his dog that he loves. And your impulse is to pick the dog up, is to pat the dog, is to... Every cell in your body wants to greet the dog.
Yes.
But you have to resist it. It's quite a moment.
And brilliantly done in Homeric verse. So this is translated into more modern prose.
And you're right, to have that scene in what is an epic. I mean, he's gone through many trials and tribulations, you know, the Cyclops and going to Hades, and then he's got this very tender domestic scene at the end. It's one of those moments in a film. I mean, you know, Christopher Nolan at the moment is shooting his version of the Odyssey. You kind of wonder what he'll do with that scene, because it is a really tense and incredibly sad scene.
Yes, I wonder.
But it's not just Odysseus and the Greeks who loved their dogs, is it? I mean, didn't you write an article about the ancient Romans and their love of dogs?
Yes, I mean, I wrote an article called The Ancients Loved Dogs,
about
too.
Patricus the dog.
Patrici.
It's Patricae, so it's evocative, it's an appeal to a male dog, is it?
No, it's a feminine dog called Patricae, equivalent to Patricia.
Oh, Patricia.
Yes.
I don't hear many Patricias being called out in Hyde Park. It's quite an unusual name for a dog, isn't it?
But Patricky, as it would have been pronounced, that would work. Patricky. And, of course, it actually means...
Never say that again, Armand.
Patricky actually means to do with the country.
Yes, so, of course.
Native.
Patria.
Patria.
Well, I read that and I did shed an Odyssean tear, I'm afraid.
Yes.
It really got me. I was tired, you know, and I was kind of a bit feeling a bit vulnerable. But it really was very touching.
Yeah, so this is an epitaph. I think it's around 2nd century Roman epitaph in Latin for a dog called
Patrici. So what I've done is I've actually translated this Latin elegiac poem into English, into rhyming verse, and here it goes. Bedewed with tears, I've brought you here, dear pup, to rest. As 15 years ago, when you my life first blessed. No more, Patrici, will you shower me with love, nor when I'm sleeping snuggle on my neck above. With grief, sweet dog, I've laid you in your marble tomb. We'll meet again forever on my day of doom. As bright and clever as a human being were you, I've lost a dearest friend, the sweetest treasure too. You'd stretch out, dear Patrici, on my lap to sup, and share my meals, lick with your little tongue the cup that I would hold and share with you, when without fail you'd welcome home your master with your wagging tail. Farewell, Patrique, go to rest where fate now calls, until we meet again one day in heaven's halls.
That's so sad. See, now, if you're listening to this and you don't own a dog, you think you're listening to two crazy people. Because you don't understand unless you own... There was an American comedian, Louis C.K., and his daughter said, "Hey, Dad, can we get a puppy? Can we get a dog?" And he said, "Sure, honey. Why don't we book an appointment in 14 years' time for a terrible grief?" Because he said, in buying the puppy, I know that in 14 years' time, the whole family will be wrecked because they'll lose this dog. I mean, this poem obviously survived, but was this a normal thing for an owner to make this kind of tribute to his pet dog?
There are actually quite a few other epitaphs. Okay.
So it was a thing back
then? Yes, it was a thing. And I mean, what it shows, I think, is how, just as today, when a beloved pet dies, one wants to memorialise it. Mm. And, you know, this does so very much as if it were a human being who had died.
Mm.
And it's very touching, I think.
It is very, very touching.
So, I mean, the other famous dog in literature is that of Martial, the poet, 2nd century AD poet. And he writes about a little dog called Issa. And he does so very specifically relating it to Catullus's sparrow. We did one of our podcast episodes on Catullus, and we talked about Lesbia's sparrow. Do you remember?
Passerella.
The passer, yes, of Catullus's Lesbia, and how it hops around on her breast and it gives her little pecks and so on. And then when the sparrow dies, her eyes are swollen and red with crying.
Mm.
Let me just read the first one, which goes, "O sparrow, you're the thing my girl loves best. She fondles you and hugs you to her breast, and teases you with wagging fingertip, drawing from time to time an eager nip. And when she's glowing from my adulation, she turns to you for welcome recreation, to find some solace for love's pain, I guess, and to relieve her amorous distress. If only I, like her, for my own part, could play with you and soothe my aching heart. But this small sign of passion, a sparrow, feels as welcome as that golden apple felt, they say, to the fleet-footed girl whose belt of virgin virtue was at last released." That myth at the end talking about Atalanta, who was the fastest of runners, and she said she wouldn't marry a man unless he could catch her, and a lot of men tried and failed. Eventually, Melanion, or Hippomenes, name differs, came along, and as he was chasing, he threw a golden apple into her path, so she stooped to pick it up, and he caught her, and he married her. And the implication for Catullus is that that was a tremendous relief for her. She finally found her husband, and he is saying, "It's going to be a great relief for me when the symbolic love indicated by this girl's love for her sparrow is transferred to me."
I think he hates this sparrow.
Well, the sparrow...
I think if he had
his
way...
is his sort of transitional object.
He'd definitely...
get rid of that thing.
Yeah.
So the poor little sparrow dies. So this was a pet that actually did die. And he then goes into an extravagant bit of poetry in poem three, in which he says that the gods of love need to now mourn because poor little sparrow's dead. So this is how it goes. "Weep, Venuses and Cupids all, and you who love's delights recall. Dead is my sweetheart's little bird, her sparrow, whom my love preferred to her own eyes. For honey sweet, it would, just like a daughter, greet my love alone, and it would stay perched on her lap and barely stray, but would hop forward and retreat, and always to its mistress tweet. But now it treads that gloomy way, to go whence none returns, they say. Damn you, infernal shades of gloom, foul death, who all sweet things consume. So sweet a bird you've snatched away, O monstrous deed, poor little stray. Now, thanks to you, the sparrow's dead, and my girl's eyes are sore and red."
Yeah, but who killed the sparrow?
Death. Death kills the sparrow. You think it's Catullus.
I think if we did a bit of detective work there, where were you, Catullus, on the night of the sparrow's death?
But the point about this poem really is in the very last line.
Yeah.
"You're smudging my girlfriend's mascara because she's crying so much. Her eyes are sore and red." So he doesn't care at all about the sparrow, despite all these...
That's heavy... plain. That's clear. It's always been clear to me for years that Catullus and the sparrow are There's no friendship there.
So Marshall then takes this poem and writes a genuinely, I think, fond poem about his little dog, Issa. Mm-hmm. And it begins, Issa is cheekier than Catullus's little bird. Issa is purer than a ring dove's kiss unheard. Issa is lovelier than every kind of girl. Issa is dearer than the most exotic pearl. Issa is the puppy of Publius's choice, with a sweet little growl just like a human voice. She sometimes feels down and she sometimes feels up. Just watch how she nestles on her master's lap, with snoring so soft you won't notice her nap. If nature should call, nothing touches the sheet. She'll paw at you gently with her little feet, and ask to get down or put back on her seat. She's so unacquainted with the facts of life, she won't find a mate, though she'd be a sweet wife. To try to keep something of her when she died, a picture for Publius was made on the side. The image came out as so good a depiction that Issa herself can't compete with the fiction. If you place the pup alongside to compare, you might think that two living puppies are there, or else that an artist has painted the pair. So that's another little poem, but it's actually a poem about a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things one does as a doting dog parent, and certainly we did in the first year of our little dogs coming to us, was get a portrait painted of her. And it's a wonderful dog portrait, in fact. And so we can hold up Ziggy next to this little picture, and it does look as if there are two dogs there.
Yeah, now, someone sent me one for Christmas, I think it was, a few years ago, and it's Sunny, but it's his head, but he's kind of dressed in a suit. It's a kind of weird-looking... It is Sunny's face, but it's in a suit. It's a kind of weird thing.
I mean, one does go over the top. One sees all sorts of things that you can get for...
Well, the amount of money, I think, people spend on their pets and their children. I mean, it's... My son, Joe, we asked him what he wanted when they were very little, and he wanted a corn snake. So we did buy a corn snake, and we fed him... Frozen mice, you know, and we'd watch it go down, and we'd watch the shape of the mouse go down the snake. And then, of course, one day, Joe left the lid off the front, because his responsibility was to feed the animal. He's about 7 years of age, and he left it off, and the corn snake went missing. Oof. And then it was discovered by somebody who put their hand down the side of the sofa, and it was that nestling down there, and she shrieked when this snake appeared.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, is very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
You alluded to earlier that the Romans in particular had other more exotic pets, because Julius Caesar, when he went off to on his expedition where he fell in love with Cleopatra, apparently came back with a giraffe.
Yes, one can't be quite as fond of a giraffe, I think, as one might.
Well, they have the biggest heart. They have the biggest heart in the animal kingdom.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. I mean, I'm not saying, you know...
They're big-hearted animals.
Of course, he came back with a whole pile of things like monkeys and lions and things, but I think he got tired of the giraffe because he ended up feeding it to the lions in the Colosseum.
Right.
As a gift to the Roman nation, as a great... Mm. So, yeah... That's probably I needed a trigger warning before I said
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think so.
Because people who are thinking about owning a giraffe might be put off by that.
Yes, I mean, I think it's likely. I mean, the Romans were pretty stony-hearted. Inevitably, there were going to be some who felt really very close and sentimentally attached to their pets. Mm. But perhaps we should accept that this was a much more cruel society than we live in today, and that the idea of hundreds or thousands of people having household pets that they adored is probably not something that we can imagine happened in Roman society or even Greek society before that.
And we read about the elite, don't we? We read about, these aren't ordinary people that we're reading about, like Caligula and his horse, Incitatus.
Incitatus, yes. Who he made a consul.
Well, and is that true?
What's true about what we learn about Caligula is not clear. So you'll have to ask Mary Beard, I'm afraid.
So the Romans that year would have been led by a horse. And they do say that at the moment America's being led by donkeys, so I guess it's up there with them. But isn't that story used as a sign of
Caligula
how mad
Caligula
was, rather than how fond he was of a horse?
Yes, yes. I mean, there are other famous horses in classical history, such as Alexander's horse, Bucephalus, for example.
Yeah.
I think one could imagine becoming extremely fond of a horse, especially if you're conquering the world.
And that's more of a less of a pet; it's more of a partnership, isn't it?
I mean,
And of course, there's always the stories of the boy being saved by the dolphin and the relationship between dolphin
Orion and the dolphin. Yes, of course, dolphins were recognised as creatures that had an affinity to human beings, and the story of Orion being saved by the dolphin when he was thrown overboard by pirates is a very touching one in Herodotus. Mm. Whether it's true or not, I mean, who knows? Some people suggest that there was a statue of a dolphin with a character on its back in Tynerum, which is the place where Orion is supposed to have ended up after he was thrown overboard.
Mm.
And that was then sort of back engineered into a story about how he had been saved by a dolphin and brought to that point. So, I mean, one can be quite cynical about some
But it speaks of a recognition of a human being thinking there's an affinity here, that there's this, and we do know that dolphins have an intelligence.
Yeah. And in fact, Pliny, we talked about Pliny the Elder and his natural history, and he does tell a story about the boy who would be carried by a dolphin to school across the bay every day. So, I mean,
there do seem to be some tales of historical value about dolphins and other creatures, other pets.
I mean, how weird would it get? Do you think someone could have a pet fly?
Well, Caligula famously tore the wings off flies.
Well,
I mean,
someone,
they weren't pets, but
someone did have
cruel.
A pet fly in the ancient world.
Really?
Yeah. None other than our great poet Virgil.
Right.
So technically it wasn't really a pet, because that would be ludicrous. A Virgil decided that he wanted to dodge this initiative that was being imposed on landowners, where they were going to give land back to veterans. And the only way you get out of having to give a chunk of your land over to a veteran would be if you could prove that your land contained a mausoleum. So the story goes, and again, it's Suetonius. So Suetonius, about whom we spoke in our episode with Mary Beard a while back, was given to saying, well, a lot of people think, plerique credunt, a lot of people say, it's a bit kind of vague, and it really doesn't feel that it's got any kind of historical verification behind it. But so the story goes, he decided to give a funeral to a pet fly, and he invited his friends. Obviously, it was some kind of joke. There's a funeral for the fly, and it's placed inside a mausoleum made of marble.
Great idea.
Must have cost him a few quid, though, to do that.
Yeah, but it's better than losing his land.
I guess so.
I have to admit, I did not know that story.
Well, I didn't know that until I read it. I mean, why wouldn't we know that about Virgil? It's one of the strangest facts I know about Virgil.
Mm. Possibly because it
might
not be
true. eels are also treated as pets.
Eels?
Murena, eels. Quintus Hortensius, this orator, he is said to have had a pet eel. And he actually put jewellery on it. He put earrings on it and a necklace and dressed it like a sort of young girl. Bit weird, do you think that is?
Very much so. I mean, so Murena, I think it's a particular type of eel, like a Murray eel,
yeah,
or lamprey.
Oh, it's no ordinary eel. This is
it's a special kind
this
of
This is
eel.
Quite a sexy eel we're talking about here with, you know, earrings and necklaces.
I understand that you can cook it in deep fried in batter and it becomes tempura.
Ah.
And so that's why we get the phrase, O tempera, O mores.
Aha.
One of us is a comedian.
It's not me this morning.
One of us got 4 A's in A level. And that wasn't me.
Let it go, Armin. Just let it go. It's very important to stave off bitterness as one gets older. Now, obviously, the big cheese general Crassus, he also had an eel.
Right.
As we know, he was the guy in the first triumvirate, wasn't he? With,
yes. Very, very wealthy man.
Big friends with Caesar and Sulla, and yet his private pleasure was he would dress up an eel. And as a quote here from, I think it's from Plutarch, he dressed up the eel like a lovely maiden.
Mm.
This is weird stuff from the Burns.
How does one get a necklace on an eel?
I think with extraordinary caution. Because if they are Murray eels, they could give you a nasty nip.
Yeah.
And if they're electric eels, even worse. But I don't know. I mean, it does beg the question, why would you do that? I mean, that's what interests me, is what's the psychology behind thinking that eel would look fabulous in a pair of drop earrings and a lovely pearl necklace?
Of course, talking of psychology, one remembers that Freud, before he became a psychologist, studied eels. You know what he was looking for? He was looking for their reproductive organs, and he could not find them. People did not know how eels reproduce.
This guy was obsessed with the reproductive organ, Freud.
Well, he was a genuine
Sigmund,
scientist.
Lift your head up. Other things to see than penises.
I think eventually they found, I'm not sure he did, but eventually they were found tucked away somewhere.
Well, clearly they have them because there are thousands of eels knocking about.
No, but the thing is they don't appear unless they're in the Sargasso Sea.
Story of my life.
There is some extraordinary story that, you know, really you can't see them until they're ready to reproduce.
Well,
that happens in one place in the world.
Very
it's
decent
one of
these
weird
of them, I think.
Things.
I think that's a nice thing that eels do, tucking it away until it's ready.
Yeah, tuck it away.
Who wants to see that hanging out of an eel?
We're happy to see the necklaces and the jewellery on the things.
Well, exactly. I mean, I guess... Would he have chosen a female eel? How would he know? If you can't find the bits, it's a guessing game, isn't it? He could have been really messing with this eel's head. This little boy eel, suddenly he's got, mind you.
I think that's fine
these days.
Yeah, I think we better not go there.
Let's not go down that road. Let's not go down Cancellation Boulevard. I do not want to get cancelled for misgendering an eel.
No, you don't.
So, summing up pets then, they definitely had them, didn't they?
They had them. They certainly felt emotional affection for dogs.
Mm.
They might have had pet birds who they also felt tearful about when they died. They did have cats. They were household cats, and I think that we even hear about pet weasels. Actually, one of my favourite stories about weasels, I mean, the word in Greek is galère.
Mm.
That means a weasel. And in Euripides' play Orestes, this is when Orestes has been chased by his mother's fury. So he's killed his mother, Clytemnestra, and he's chased by them. And he's in a total state of frenzy because he thinks there are these horrid creatures after him all the time. So he's jumping up and down and trying to shoot them with his bow and arrow, or he's lying down and trying to snatch some sleep between these horrid visions. So at the beginning of the play... This is what's happening, Euripides Orestes. And he comes out of a trance and he utters the words in Greek, out of the waves, out of the billows of my frenzy, I once again see calm. And the word for calm, or I see calm in Greek, is galen horo. And if you change the accent on galen, you get Galen with a circumflex accent, it means a weasel.
Mm.
The unfortunate actor, his name was Hegelicus. He was a famous actor in his day, but we really know of him because he committed this awful mispronunciation. And he said, you know, coming out of the billows of my frenzy, once again I see a weasel. And everybody fell about.
Big laugh.
This is, you know, this is a serious tragedy. And they were all laughing in the aisles. And poor old Hegelicus never lived it down. We actually have fragments of four comedies in which someone said, oh, look, a weasel.
All right.
You know, so they really had a go at this poor man.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armin Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible, alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject. They hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.